What do astronauts, video games, and graveside flowers have in common? They're all subject matter in the poetry of Kansas native Ben Lerner. Now a New Yorker and an acclaimed novelist and essayist, he was named a 2015 MacArthur Fellow. So we're revisiting the early genius of one of the youngest poets ever to be a finalist for the National Book Award as the then 20-something Ben Lerner talks about poetry, puzzles, and form on this archive edition of New Letters on the Air, a production of New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elam. Ben Lerner originally hails from Topeka, Kansas, where he graduated from high school in 1997. He went east to study political theory at Brown University and then stayed to get his MFA in creative writing. Lerner's first book, The Lichtenberg Figures, won the Hayden Carruth Award from Copper Canyon Press and was named one of the best poetry books of 2004 by Library Journal. So perhaps it's not so much of a surprise that his second book, Angle of Yaw, was a 2006 National Book Award finalist. I talked with Ben Lerner in 2007 when he was a visiting speaker at the Kansas City Art Institute to discuss his poetry and his influences, including a poet who's mentioned often in his work, Cesar Vallejo.
He's mattered to a lot of kind of experimental American poets. He was one of the first poets to kind of use several different vocabularies that are usually kept separate at once in a poem. So he would use like scientific jargon, or he would use religious language, or he would use some touches of the indigenous languages of Peru. It refuses any kind of easy compartmentalization between literary language and language in the world. That matters to me about Vallejo.
Let's talk about your two books. The first book, The Lichtenberg Figures, is written more in verse form, and the second book you tended to approach in small, almost like prose paragraphs.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about what it is you're trying to do with form?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of times formal poet kind of in the United States refers to people who write only in traditional forms with like meter and rhyme.
But as a sonnet or,
right,
you know, something
right,
like that.
As a traditional sonnet. But I do think of myself as a formal poet, but I think of form, but not just working in received forms. I mean, the first book is a sonnet sequence of a sort. And one of the things I was interested in that book is kind of seeing how much violence the sonnet form could sustain before it kind of lost any principle of structural coherence. Like, I was interested in kind of wreaking havoc on the form. And because of the centrality of the sonnet in Western poetry, like playing with the sonnet is kind of evoking a whole cultural tradition. So it was a way of like having an argument with poetry, you know, through the form of the sonnet, to see if the sonnet could be relevant to contemporary experience, for instance. And in the first book, I was interested in the way that the sonnet, as a set of rules, kind of does violence to the materials of experience, you know, how you have to fit your experience into this kind of prepackaged form. And then at the same time, I was interested in doing the violence to the sonnet that I mentioned, bending or breaking the rules in order to see how much mutation it could sustain. So in a way, the role of the sonnet in the book is thematic and not just formal. I wanted there to be a parallel between the violence that the poems often recount and the violence that was taking place on the level of structure, on the level of the form itself.
I knew that you were playing with the form because you have the right amount of lines,
right,
most of the time. But I hadn't really thought about the violence within the poem. You were also trying to do violence to the form.
Right. That's why, I mean, the title of the book, you know, a Lichtenberg figure is this pattern that appears and often quickly fades from the backs of lightning strike victims. And it's beautiful. And I like part of why that is a kind of guiding trope of the book appealed to me is because I thought that that was an interesting instance of how form happens violently in the world. And so, I mean, I guess the way that the body registers the shock of the lightning strike and it produces this beautiful form, I wanted the forms of the poem to register the various kinds of personal and cultural shocks that they describe and to make the sonnet kind of show the shock of the experiences that it recounts.
Well, I've got several things marked in here, but why don't I let you pick out something that you think best shows that, what you're trying to do with the form and the violence?
This poem goes, "The sky is a big responsibility, and I am the lone intern. This explains my drinking. This explains my luminous portage, my baboon heart that breaks nightly like the news. Who am I kidding? I am Diego Rodriguez Velasquez. I am a dry and eviscerated analysis of the Russian Revolution. I am Line 7, and my memory, like a melon, contains many dark seeds. Already, this poem has achieved the status of lore amongst you little people of New England. Nevertheless, I, Dr. Samuel Johnson, experience moments of such profound alienation that I have surrendered my pistols to the care of my sister, Elizabeth Nietzsche. Forgive me, for I have taken things too far. And now your carpet is ruined. Forgive me, for I am not who you think I am. I am Charlie Chaplin, playing a waiter embarrassed by his occupation, and when the rich woman I love enters this bistro, I must pretend that I'm only pretending to play a waiter for her amusement.
You're listening to Ben Lerner, and he's been reading from the Lichtenberg Figures here on New Letters on the Air.
I chose this poem in part because it violates several different kinds of conventions at once, right? I mean, it makes a display of violating the idea that the I in a poem is a stable historical self that expresses his or her feelings, and the kind of radical shifts between persona and the way that the I in this poem is shown to be very unreliable, making all of these different preposterous historical claims, was one of the conventions of a lot of poetry I wanted to subvert. So already one thing the poem works against is the assumption of a stable, univocal I. And I think that in the sonnet sequence, it's several times the poems go out of their way to make sure that the speaker isn't trustworthy, and to kind of render more problematic the relationship between the historical author and what's expressed in the poem. Another moment in this poem that I think is indicative of one of the things I'm interested in the sonnet is the line that says, I am line 7 is actually line 6. And so these poems are always commenting on their own forms and kind of taking the sonnet to task. And just as you can't, you know, trust the I who claims to be Velasquez or the I that might be Ben Lerner, the I that in other poems is Cesar Vallejo, the poem also is shown to be unreliable in its own self-commentary, claiming that line 6 is actually line 7. So the self-consciousness and the playing with personae in this poem, I think, are indicative of messing with the conventions of the sonnet in order to make those conventions visible and in order to be able to make statements about poetry, not just statements in poetry.
Ben Lerner, you are a puzzle maker, aren't you? I mean, you really enjoy that part of the poetic world where you really are layering things one on top of another and making something that you can switch around and move around and just puzzle with.
And a sonnet sequence is very much a puzzle. I mean, each poem is supposed to kind of be able to stand on its own as a discrete work of art, but the meaning of a particular poem is constantly redefined by the next term in the sequence. The meaning in the poems are always shifting, and one of the things that interests me about extended forms, like, you know, a sonnet sequence or a series of prose poems instead of just one or two prose poems, is the possibility for repetition and recombination and collage and the creation of expectations that are then, you know, met or strategically disappointed. Because like in comedy, you know, you have certain poems that set up other poems, so your punchlines are unexpected and have force. I do think of it as a kind of making of puzzles, or at least is there a lot of traps?
Yeah, right? A maze, that kind of puzzle. The other thing that you do in this book, in the Lichtenberg Figures, more so than in The Angle of Yaw, is that you really play with words. I have to confess, I had to go to the dictionary several times when I was reading the Lichtenberg Figures, because you were choosing a more rarefied word for something that could be commonplace.
Right.
I mean, particular flowers that you're leaving at a place where this one character who keeps reoccurring in
right.
your collection of poems, he's died and you've left it where his
mm-hmm.
Honda has flipped. Why don't I just have you read the first two lines? Because that'll show what I'm talking about
oh, yeah.
with your use of language
yeah.
and finding words and stuff.
Right.
So.
Right. The first two lines are, I place a terminal raceme of fragrant funnel-shaped perianths beside the mile marker where Orlando flipped his Honda. I do this often in the book. It's a very good observation where instead of, you know, a bouquet of flowers or whatever, there's some kind of shockingly technical language used to describe it. And you're right that the most difficult language in the book almost always occurs where a more familiar word would suffice. In part is emphasizing the degree to which that's such a radically insufficient gesture to try to commemorate the loss of someone with flowers, you know, shows our kind of impotence in the face of cataclysm, and that a way of emphasizing that without just describing that was to use language that showed how incommensurate death was on the one hand and these pieces of botany on the other, right? I mean, so the strange language makes the practice strange, and that strangeness can have a thematic effect in the poem. Using unexpected language or really prosing out a description or exaggerating the specificity of a description is a part of a larger project of trying to make the language strange again so it's not just cliche, which of course has a desensitizing effect. So to freshen the experience, you often have to estrange the language, and I think that's behind my selection of those kinds of, you know, technical words instead of a term that might be near at hand.
Do you ever worry as a poet about losing your readers because of that? I mean, you know, them maybe not having the patience to go to their dictionary or something, or is the reader that you're trying to attract is somebody that you want to take that time to puzzle through it?
That's a good and complicated question. I mean, the answer is yes, I worry about it. I mean, I think you have to constantly negotiate, on the one hand, a desire for formal innovation and experiment and the difficulty that attends that kind of writing. On the other hand, I don't want to surrender the communicative capacity of the poem. So I do think about that. One thing that happens a lot in my work is I write that anxiety about accessibility directly into the poem. I mean, I'll write in my poems about whether or not anybody is listening. The last line of Angle of Yaw is this thing on, you know, as if it were a microphone and I wasn't sure if I was getting a response. So I think that anxiety is actually expressed in the project. And in a way, expressing that anxiety is a way of solving the problem because it opens up this conversation, you know, within the poems. I think it's a way of engaging readers. Like, the reader has to think about what it would mean for these poems to be too difficult. I mean, should poetry be something that's easy to decipher, or is there something to be said for poetry that challenges normal modes of communication and normal kinds of language use? I mean, the other thing is, every time I get really worried that my work is inaccessible, like the other day I read in San Francisco as part of an event with Small Press Distribution at City Lights with a lot of high school students and different kinds of poets, slam poets, you know, and I mean, on the way there, I was really worried, and this has happened to me a lot, like, no one's going to get it, it's going to seem exclusive or too
esoteric.
The high school kids really get it and have interesting things to say about it, and when they don't get it, they have interesting things to say about that. Like, maybe it's okay to not understand every line. Like, maybe you don't have to go to your dictionary. I mean, people who enjoy a great piece of music or an abstract painting often don't try to reduce it to its paraphrasable content. And I think that difficulty in poetry is only really a problem if you think that you read a poem exclusively for information. You know, there are other ways to read a poem, for the music or for the emotional effect, without necessarily being able to say why you feel that particular way. There's no way that a book of my poems is going to be as accessible as a political speech by George Bush, but the reason why it's not going to be as accessible is hopefully because it's actually saying something, right? And it actually has something happening formally that can be a meaningful experience as a reader. So accessibility is important to me, and it's something I think a lot about, but I think that generally, the rapper Chuck D talks a lot about the dumb assification of American culture, and I think he's on to something. I mean, I think there is a real kind of race towards the bottom, and I believe there are readers who can grapple with these poems.
I think so. And I've often, just dealing with all kinds of poetry, sometimes there's just stuff that you have to let wash over you. Right. And you're absolutely right. When people listen to music, they don't try to understand every little thing that's going on within a symphony. They're just taking it in and enjoying it as they can.
Yeah.
Well, let's hear one more from this particular collection. And I think this one kind of goes along with what we've been talking about. So this is from towards the end of the Lichtenberg figures. Here's Ben Lerner.
In the early zeros, my concern with abstraction culminated in a series of public exhalations. I was praised for my use of repetition, but alas, my work was understood. Then the towers collapsed, and anti-missile missiles tracked the night sky with ellipses. I decided that what we needed was a plain style, not more condoms stuffed with chocolate frosting. After 6 months in my studio, I emerged and performed a series of public exhalations. Only time will tell if my work is representational. Only time will tell if time will tell. I mean, this poem is a bizarre poem. This poem does take up a lot of the issues that we were discussing. I mean, largely, it's a poem that kind of makes fun of and also expresses some sorrow about this constant conversation of the kind of insular art world that's doing bizarre performance art, like the condom stuff with chocolate frosting, which I've actually seen as an exhibit. And then, you know, on the other hand, this desire for plain speech, especially in the face of national tragedy, and the feeling that maybe poetry should have something to say about that. I mean, it was interesting after September 11th, a lot of American experimental poets who are committed to projects that are often described as esoteric started writing poems that were much more accessible and that made direct modal statements and that expressed grief or political outrage in a very accessible way. I mean, this is a constant conversation about, on the one hand, wanting to innovate formally in your poetry, and on the other, wanting to be able to make direct statements. And this poem, with both humor and some real sadness, talks about the kind of contradictions of that. You know, on the one hand, there's a desire to be representational. On the other hand, what counts as representational depends upon the adventures that we're willing to take in our artwork. You know, when Picasso painted Gertrude Stein's portrait and everybody said this doesn't look anything like her, he said, it will. And I mean, I think it was a very profound, I mean, on the one hand, it was just his incredible hubris, right?
Right.
And on the other hand, it was a very profound statement about the way representation works. Like, this is a way of seeing that's inaccessible at first, but it's an accomplished vision, and eventually it'll come to redefine what's possible. I mean, I think that that's true for poetry, that it's going to take difficulty and experiment and inaccessibility in order to, you know, move the goalposts of what's considered to be accessible or representable in verse.
I'd like to, besides the fact that you have this conversation that we've been having within a poem, too, that you're talking about your own repetition and, but alas, my work was understood, which was really funny, and then you juxtapose it right away up against the towers collapsing. You do that as well within your poetry.
Yeah,
you know,
that's
you
right.
have the humor and then the sadness, the pathos, you know, just right. smack up against each other.
Yeah, I hope so. Yeah, that's what I'm trying to do.
Before we leave the Lichtenberg figures, mm-hmm. Orlando. Was Orlando a true person?
No, that's not a real person. I mean, he functions as a kind of figure of violence in the book. It's a, you know, another persona that the speaker interacts with. And in a very violent dialogue. I think he's a figure, for one thing, for kind of violent masculine rivalry, which is a theme of the book, and the destruction that is, you know, that's the issue of that kind of tension.
And also that bullying.
Right.
You know, he's the ultimate bully.
And right. And so. He's also, you know, this person who receives a lot of violence at the hand of the speaker. And one thing that the book does is it has moments of shocking violence in it that are often stylized in poetry or not available in poetry, and it's delivered with a very flat affect. It's not passion or anything like that. And that's actually a kind of violence that I witnessed a lot growing up that I think is very characteristic of contemporary America that I think poetry should be able to address. Violence that doesn't, you know, arise from deeply held conflicting beliefs or just, you know, like moments of passion, but this kind of violence, you know, that's like typified by the Columbine High School massacre. There's usually white, middle class, adolescent men who, for reasons that are difficult to define, are undertaking these tremendous acts of violence. And Orlando Duran is kind of a made-up personification of that violence.
It's interesting, too, because there are several allusions in your work to video games, too, right. and the violence that occurs within those. And the angle of y'all, you were talking a while ago about different ways that poetry can affect people and the musicality of it. And again, these poems were written more in, as we were saying before, the prose line.
Mm-hmm. In the second book, the reason why I was interested in the prose line is in part that the second book is very interested in a lot of contemporary discourses that tend to be prose, like the language of advertising or the language of contemporary political doublespeak or military euphemism or whatever. So the prose line was an opportunity to try to inhabit those ways of talking from the inside in order to make them strange or to subvert them. In both books, there's a similar concept of form, the idea that form should do something thematic, like it should have a role in the way the content of the poems is experienced. But they are very different forms, and they're different forms in part because I had different thematic concerns.
And they appear on the page sort of in the center of the page.
Right.
You've got a lot of white space, so they're framed in a way.
Yeah, yeah.
And
I'm glad you picked up. I mean, that's important to me in that book, in part because it gives you the kind of experience of maybe like how you see a billboard, right, in an otherwise empty area, or the way you might look down on something if you saw it from a great height. And two of the big concerns of the book are advertising and the kind of billboard culture. And another concern of the book that's signaled in the title in a kind of obscure way is our kind of obsession with being able to feed our culture an image of itself, with getting to look down, you know, on the halftime show from the Goodyear blimp and see our own image on the screen, or the way that those images of seen from above are associated with air wars, which is the preferred form of state violence in the First World, right? My whole life, I've seen these images of the planet seen from above. And one thing the book is interested in is the way that that image, the way we see ourselves, has kind of replaced a more traditional philosophy in which we imagine God seeing us. So the way that a kind of camera has replaced the God term is one of the big philosophical interests in the book. And there have been some brilliant theorists about how technologies of viewing have changed our thinking about religion and have changed the way we relate to one another socially, people like Walter Benjamin or Guy Debord. And those are writers who have been important to me. So the use of white space on the page is in part a way of structurally staging that, a subtle way. I mean, I don't know how many readers feel that way, but I was happy to hear you talk about the way they're framed.
I think I'll have you read this. It sort of ties into what we were just talking about with video games.
Sure. The first gaming system was the domesticated flame. Contemporary video games allow you to select the angle from which you view the action, inspiring a rash of high school massacres. Newer games, with their use of small strokes to simulate reflected light, are all but unintelligible to older players. We have abstracted airplanes from our simulators in the hope of manipulating flight as such. Game cheats, special codes that make your character invincible or rich, alter weather conditions, or allow you to bypass a narrative stage, stand in relation to video games as prayer to reality. Children, if pushed, will attempt to inflict game cheats on the phenomenal world. Enter up, down, up, down, left, right, A, B, A to tear open the sky. Left, left, B, B to keep warm.
That's included in the second section of The Angle of Yaw. What is the angle of yaw?
So the angle of yaw is often a nautical term. Like if you imagine like a boat that's plotted a certain course, but that for environmental reasons or for whatever reasons is thrown off that course and it wavers as it moves in that direction, it's the angle of that wavering that's called the angle of yaw. And there were several reasons why that concept was important to me. I mean, one thing is that it's measured from above, that angle, and so it signals that concern with how we look down on ourselves. Another thing is the book is full of political outrage and is very interested in how the American ship of state has wavered from the course that was supposedly plotted in something like, you know, the Bill of Rights or the Constitution. So there's that metaphor. A third thing that really interests me about the title is the way that sonically, on the level of sound, it has a kind of religious feel because of Angle's relation to angel or Yah's relation to Yahweh. So the title itself kind of links this idea of measuring from above in a scientific way with the metaphysical idea or the religious idea of the God term and this God or Yahweh that looks down on us and the angels that mediate from, you know, this higher plane of the divine to the earthly.
I love that as sort of a shadow title, The Angels of Yahweh.
Right.
You know,
right.
Just that's great. And, again, and
angels,
playing with words.
Right, and angels are everywhere in the book.
I like the cover of the book, too, because you have, as you were talking about, how it gets off course, there's kind of a jagged line
right
here and some things that sort of connotate modern electricity and
yeah
being able to communicate somehow.
That cover is courtesy of NASA, actually, because
really?
It's in the public domain. There's something called the Voyager Golden Album, which was this thing that was put together by NASA that was supposed to be representative of the diversity of life on Earth, and we broadcast it into space in case anybody is listening. And so the cover also, right, you know, signals this, you know, in the absence of a lot of like religious faith, this kind of reaching out into outer space to try to once again, you know, kind of define who we are. So I also liked the idea of using the public domain to get a government image on that cover. This is a good thing about poetry. You know, the government isn't watching you very closely in this country. But the book is critical of the space race. I mean, there's an early poem in there, which is basically just a transcription of, you know, things I overheard, which is that there was a big debate a while back when China, you know, had an astronaut in orbit who claimed to not be able to see any of the structures that American astronauts always claim are visible from space in our country, right? He claimed to only be able to see the Great Wall, whereas the American astronauts make a big point of how you can also see the light from the Luxor Casino in Las Vegas. And I was interested in the way that visible from space had replaced in the eyes of God as a concept. You know, to get a NASA image on the cover was fortuitous for me.
You know, there's actually a poem in here, speaking of the astronauts, there's one about women.
Yeah.
Women in space. Why don't I get you to read that?
Women have no desire to travel in outer space. When men have forced women to travel in outer space, the results have been disastrous. If you mention space travel to a woman, she will say, don't even go there. She will say, you can't go home again. She will say, been there, done that, that there is more space inside one small woman than in all of heaven has been verified experimentally. She will say, have I gained weight? She will say, I no longer love you, and or I'm not sure I ever loved you. She will say, most theorists believe the universe is flat. The first woman in space is still there. And space travel in this book is this bizarre journey, you know, as we've kind of been talking about, which is compensating for this vacuum where we don't have a confidence in our, like, relation to a higher being. And so, you know, both men and women throughout the book, astronauts, are described as suffering immensely from this journey and returning to the Earth really traumatized by the confrontation with the vacuum where God was supposed to be. You know, I'm of that generation where the Challenger explosion, you know, which had the teacher who was killed, this real tragedy, a strangely defining event for us who were in, like, elementary school at the time. The astronaut, for me, is the human version of the angel. But it's a bad deal for the astronauts. You know, it's dangerous. It has a military connotation. So I don't know how much of that makes sense, but there's a way that there's the movement from the angel to Earth, which is the old metaphysical way of mediating between, you know, the secular world and the divine. And then there's the astronaut
going up.
Right. So it's this movement on this vertical axis that interests me, and that the astronaut is in a way punished for playing God.
Ben Lerner. He read from his first two award-winning poetry books, The Lichtenberg Figures and Angle of Yaw, while a 2007 visiting speaker at the Kansas City Art Institute. Astronauts come up again in his second novel, published in 2014, called 1004. Lerner was awarded the MacArthur Genius Fellowship in fall 2015. For links, visit newletters.org and click On the Air, where you can also sign up for our free weekly podcast under Ways to Listen, or find us on iTunes. Follow us on Facebook, Tumblr, and Twitter at New Letters Radio. New Letters on the Air is a production of New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, with partial financial support from the Missouri Arts Council, a state agency. Today's show was originally produced with Danette Alexander, Lenny Nuccio, Chelsea Seguin, and Dennis Conroe. Thanks also to Abby Jamison, Danny Moran, and Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.